I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton,
I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how are you doing, podcats? Adam Buxton here. And, oh, look at this. What are we looking at? Let me tell you what I'm looking at. Out here in the Norfolk countryside. It's like a kind of special effect. Because on this day, Sunday, the 8th of November, as I speak, it is now coming up to 4:30. In an hour, it will be completely dark. But it's been a lovely, mild, almost balmy day out here in the countryside. Very beautiful. And now that the evening chill is setting in, I guess the earth that has been warmed up by the sun is now making it misty in little localized patches that look like ghost areas. It's quite cool. Look, Rosie, the mist is chasing us from over there. There's just a big, weird patch of mist. And it's coming towards us. Let's run away! Run away! Come on, Rosie. Sorry, I didn't mean to freak you out. Rosie's looking at me now like, what is your problem? Do you want to go up the exciting hill where the cows usually are? I think the cows have gone away now for the winter. So we won't be antagonizing them. Yes. But let me tell you a bit about podcast number 138, which features a laughter and music-filled conversational ramble with frontman of Scottish band Travis, Fran Healy. Fran facts, Fran, currently aged 47, grew up in Glasgow, Scotland, and joined Travis on the day he enrolled at the Glasgow School of Art in the autumn of 1991. Having been invited to join by drummer Neil Primrose. Lineup changes. I love saying lineup changes because it makes me feel like a music journalist. And I'm really pulling the stops out with my music journalese in this intro. Lineup changes saw Fran's art school friend Dougie Payne joining as bass player. Andy Dunlop had been there from the start on guitar. Just opening the gate. Now the gate is closed. The band's second album, The Man Who, released in 1999 and featuring production from regular Radiohead producer Nigel Godrich, featured the singles Turn, Writing to Reach You, Driftwood and Why Does It Always Rain on Me. After initially slow sales, The Man Who ended up selling over 3.5 million copies around the world. That's so many copies. And turned Travis into a headline act, seemingly plastered across the cover of every UK music mag as the new millennium dawned. Their 2001 album, The Invisible Band, recorded once again with Nigel Godrich, also made it to the number one spot and contained more great, great hits. Sing, Side, and Flowers in the Window. In 2002, various factors, including a nearly fatal spinal injury sustained by Neil Primrose while jumping in a pool, contributed to Travis taking a step back, just as bands like Keane and most especially Coldplay were stepping up to snaffle the lion's share of the melodic guitar pop pie. I mean, this is great writing from Buckles. Every member of Travis ended up starting a family over the next few years, but they've never stopped touring and producing music, albeit in a way slightly more conducive to family life. Fran directed the documentary Almost Fashionable, released in 2018, which contained great performances of some of the band's best-loved songs, played to ecstatic fans in Mexico, interspersed with thoughts from music writers about why this gang of likeable Scots making tuneful and accessible music had the capacity to occasionally rub critics up the wrong way. My conversation with Fran was recorded face to socially distanced face in a London music studio back in early October of this year, just before I hosted a Q&A with the whole band, which was streamed live to their fans around the world to celebrate the release of their ninth studio album, 10 Songs. Rosie! Rosie, I'm going this way. Fly past from the hairy bullet. It was very good to see the Travis boys again. As you'll hear, we spent quite a bit of time hanging out at the end of the 90s and on into the early 2000s. And though I still see Dougie now and then, Fran has lived abroad for the last 15 years or so in places like New York, Berlin, and now Los Angeles with his partner Nora and their son Clay. And it had been a long time since we'd caught up. We dealt with some of the slightly more grown-up topics of conversation while I was setting up my mics. But by the time I hit record, we were somewhere a bit more juvenile. And there was a smutty motif that ran through much of our conversation. Just so you're aware, in case that's going to be an issue for you, there was quite a bit of onanistic chit-chat. Wanky chat. But there's also thoughts on creativity and the mysterious process of songwriting, why comedians and musicians like hanging out with each other, some pretty good name dropping, and a bit of resolution after a drunken row that got out of hand 15 years ago. Back at the end for a small helping of waffle, but right now with Fran Healy, here we go.
Is this the podcast?
This is the podcast. Right, okay. So you don't have to answer this, but you know, nowadays, I don't know how it is in your house, but I find that sometimes, like after a certain age, when you've been with your partner for a long time, mm-hmm. you don't have quite as much sexy time as maybe you once did when you first met.
Yeah.
But maybe you still carry on having solo fun on a semi-regular basis.
It's the best fun to have.
Sure, yeah. And it's convenient, it's easy to schedule.
It's portable.
Yeah. Have you ever had a situation where you've had some solo fun and that's all finished, and then suddenly your partner makes it clear that actually there's a sexy time invitation on the table, but you're not in a position to take up the offer?
All right.
Because you've just finished your business.
Yeah, I've emptied the cistern. Flushed.
Yeah.
No. Can you remember your first wank?
Yes, although it wasn't a formal one. It wasn't a kind of manual one.
What?
With me,
did you have one of those weird contraptions that you put over it?
A fleshlight.
What?
It's called the fleshlight.
Oh, my God.
Because it looks like a flesh-coloured torch. With a kind of rubbery mm-hmm. fanny on the end. So it's all portable.
Right.
The fleshlight. Maybe it doesn't exist anymore, but there used to be adverts for them everywhere you went on the internet, or at least everywhere I went.
Pushing them towards you. Yes, you need this.
Aha. No, for me, my first experiences of that kind of thing, autoerotic joy, mm-hmm. were climbing up rope at gym class.
Andy talks about that.
And when I saw Wayne's World, there's a line in there and Garth says, "It made me feel kind of funny, you know, like when you climb the rope at gym class."
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, I thought that was just me.
That's interesting. My one was guy who was in our class at school. He was much taller than everyone else and much more mature. Mm-hmm. That's like primary 7, I think, which was 11 years, 12 years old. You know, you've not got any thoughts even in your head at that point. But he came in one day and he's like, "Whoa, let me tell you something." And we were all sitting around the table and he's like, "What?" And then you just rub it. And then you... and I was like... I was just in the background kind of nodding, going...
Mm-hmm.
So that night, I was in my room. I thought, I'm going to give it a little rub.
And...
And it suddenly, I was like, wow. And hey, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Except not out the hands.
Wow.
It really does feel like a superpower.
Yeah. No, it took me quite a while, I think, before I went the traditional route. Because after that, there was quite a long period of sliding around on the in the bath. On my front.
Wow. When How old were you?
I was pretty young, I think. I mean, I was way ahead of my time.
Did you get pubes before all the other boys?
I certainly wasn't lagging behind, but no, there was a guy I remember seeing in the showers, and he had a man's knob. He must have been only...
There's always one of them.
Yeah. He must have been just 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And he had a grown man's knob.
It's like God's Photoshop.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that on him. Do you know, inversely, there's probably a guy, a grown man, somewhere with a child. And he's like, "Why have I got this baby dick?" Oh my God.
And I was absolutely fascinated by it, though. I remember thinking, like, holy shit, look at the equipment on this guy. And it was so bushy and big, and I was like, wow. And I didn't want it, though. I wasn't envious.
No.
But did you never go through a phase of feeling guilty and anxious about all that kind of thing?
About what? Wanking?
Yeah.
No.
No.
No, well, no. I mean, I should have, because I brought up a Catholic. But no, not at all. I was like, wow, this is the greatest thing that has ever happened to me. And probably still is to this day. Better than, like, you know, getting a record deal. Nothing comes close, actually.
It's the gift that keeps giving.
Do you... I find it hard to believe that there's people out there who don't ever, you know,
mm-hmm.
dabble.
Sure.
And there are.
Absolutely. People abstain, don't they? Who was I listening to the other day? I was listening to a podcast with Russell Brand, mm-hmm. and he was talking about the fact that he no longer pleasures himself.
Why?
Because he said, since he's had children, he has a daughter, I think, maybe more than one, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. He finds it too weird. He thinks that it's strange to compartmentalize his sexuality in that way. He's not able to do it. So he finds it too creepy to be having wanky time on his own and thinking sexy thoughts and maybe looking at pictures of other people. And then going and being a more wholesome version of himself with his children.
Mm.
And so he's decided just to knock it on the head. Mm. Or at least he had done. This was 2018, I think the podcast was from. But I thought, gosh, that's weird, because that compartmentalization is a fundamental aspect of being a human being, really.
It's part of the fun.
Yeah, exactly. As you say, it's part of the fun. You know, you can be a different person if you're having consensual sex or you're on your own or whatever. You're indulging and you're working through various...
Characters?
Yeah, characters, styles. You know, maybe also you're working through stuff that you know is not really acceptable. I mean, I'm not, you know...
Well, let's not go
Let's just
that.
Assume I'm talking about stuff that is not totally beyond the pale. But maybe it's stuff that you would be embarrassed to do with your partner or I don't know what. We're only... This is the very beginning of the podcast. But, you know, that's what... Human sexuality is a mysterious thing.
To put it simply, we're all kind of schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
We have our cerebral selves, which is where... What's his name? Russell.
Oh, yeah, Russell Brand.
It's where Russell has gone. He's gone into his head, so he's thinking about it. And the monkey, because everyone's got the animal, you know. Mm-hmm. It's your emotional core, and it's kind of the one that has these urges. I wouldn't say they're thoughts, because it's an urge before you think, oh, I'm going to, you know, your mind clicks onto it. So I think you've got two things, and you have to satisfy both the animal and the cerebral part. So, you know, for the cerebral part, you might, I don't know, go and see a Radiohead concert. And yeah. Then the monkey part, you might want to
go
do
see
that.
Travis.
You might want to, no, you might want to do that while you watch the Radiohead concert. I mean, whatever, like you say, whatever,
yeah,
whatever floats your boat. Could you imagine just an audience of people?
Kill two birds with one stone, all, yeah. Oh, someone must have had a wank at a Radiohead concert.
Absolutely. On stage. Oh, God. Here's the thing, though. You, the first time I met you...
I was masturbating.
No.
No.
No, no, no. It was an indirect meeting because I saw your sketch on Big Train.
Oh, yeah.
The wanking sketch, which is still one of the best sketches
ever. Yeah, I know.
Ever.
I like to take credit for it. I mean, I've said before, I've explained the situation before, that Graham Linehan got in touch with us. He had been watching the Adam and Joe show and he liked it. It was one of the first messages, one of the first emails I received from someone I didn't know. And it was so exciting. I was like, oh, my God. And then he said, would you and Joe like to write some ideas for Big Train? And we were like, yeah, sure. But they were like two-line ideas, most of them, you know. And one of them that I wrote was, what if wanking in the office was like smoking? Or maybe I didn't even write that. Maybe I'm giving myself too much credit. But it was basically wanking in the office.
Yeah.
And I think I wrote something else about it being just, you know, a very banal part of office life and scheduling a wank with the secretary and that kind of thing. And then Graham and Arthur took it in a different direction, and then Simon and all the rest of the cast improvised very brilliantly with it. But I still take credit for the sketch.
So that was the first time I was aware of you, but without realising you were part of that.
Yeah, you guys were into all that stuff. Because I remember in The Man Who, on the sleeve notes, I think you did a thank you to...
To Big Train.
To Big Train, yeah. Right.
I found it so high-minded. Back then, I didn't know it was Graham Linehan who'd done Father Ted, and then he went on to Black Books after that.
Yes.
And then, obviously, I met him through you. And he's just this... He's so smart. And again, through you and through other comedians, I realised, oh, comedians are actually the smartest people that you can kind of meet, you know, all the guys that go
I'm
around.
And quiet.
But you kind of are, you know. I would never, like, I hate going out with comedians on a night out because you just get absolutely ripped to bits. It's horrific and it's funny. You just daren't open your mouth, you know.
Do you think that? But comedians are all in awe of musicians, though.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because they envy that ability to express themselves in a sincere way without having to constantly deflect everything with humor.
Hmm.
That's my theory. I just made that up. Hmm. But it's got to be something about that. It's got to be something about that level of authenticity and not having to make everything funny. I just envy the ability that you have and people like you have to write a song, to express an emotion without having to lean on humor. I can't even conceive of how you would begin to do that. To evoke a sincere feeling.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think comedians are really cerebral. But the funny bone people like Stan Laurel, Chaplin, for instance, Buster Keaton, all the original guys, they're quick. There's a quickness to them. And as I guess I've, over the years, I'm so attracted to that, more than musicians actually, because this quickness, this like real watching people doing magic in front of you when they're not just reading a joke off a sheet. They're just funny people, like you say, funny boned people.
Yeah.
It's super smart.
It's a nice relationship though, because everyone gets something out of it. They like hanging around with the musician.
Yeah.
Because can we do lots of name dropping in this conversation?
Yeah, sure.
Love it. I love it. And actually, you know, if we have time and if we feel mentally able, we could even go a little bit deep into why I might love name dropping so much.
Okay.
And what bearing it might have on a big row that you and I once had. Is this ringing any bells?
We only had one row.
Yeah. The row at the wedding.
Oh, that was a row.
Yeah, man.
Well, okay.
Yeah?
Well, yeah.
Well, we've teased it. We'll build towards it.
That was a row.
That was a massive row.
You shouted at me. You made me cry.
Mate.
Let's go there later.
Don't spoil it.
Don't spoil the row.
Okay.
But, okay, name dropping. I met Ben Stiller because you brought him along to a show. Was that a Travis show? We were at the Brixton Academy. And who were we seeing?
I have no idea.
We went to see someone. Maybe it was Weezer or...
Pixies?
Maybe Pixies, yeah. That might be right. Yeah. And so I think I knew that I was going to meet you, but then maybe you phoned up beforehand, pre-texting days, and said, can I bring my friend Ben Stiller? And I was like, yeah, all right. And how did you know him?
I can't remember that. I mean, I literally have no... No recollection.
It must have been around 2003, 2004.
Yeah.
Anyway, I remember sitting around and chatting a little bit beforehand and being immediately struck by how kind of intense Ben was as a person. Like, he's got quite a cerebral aspect.
He's got that, I guess it's that thing that there's a seriousness. Like I say, that there is that a lot of comedians and musicians, we're different than we are on stage. Mm-hmm. We go on stage and we turn ourselves inside out almost. And I think he's no exception. But as a fan, you expect someone to be...
Yeah.
I mean, I've met lots of comedians who I expect to be the same as they are. And some are, like Ricky Gervais is. He's probably even more outrageous in person than he is when he's on stage. And he is outrageous on stage as well. But a lot of guys go back to normal again. Mm-hmm. They put their normal thing on and they listen. That's what I've noticed a lot about, like, people like that. They're quiet. They just sort of, they're just taking it in and listening.
Filling the chuckle tank.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hoovering it all up in order to spew it out later. That's quite nice, though, isn't it, for you to have these people that you like and admire be attracted to you?
Yeah, it's really cool.
Because you went, like, tell me at any point, like, oh, I don't really want to talk about that.
Oh, right.
That's just a bit too tacky. But I couldn't believe, I remember sometime early in the 2000s, you went on holiday with Billy Connolly.
Yeah. The very cool thing about that little episode, it was Billy's 60th birthday. Mm-hmm. He had a birthday in Scotland, and we'd gone to that. And that was, like, an amazing thing, the big event. Because he is like a British superhero. Mm-hmm. Billy's just, first of all, one of the greatest storytellers ever and observers of life and points, you know, the mirror back at everyone. And it just explains things. That's what great stories and humour and songs and all that, it fills in the blanks. And with him, you're laughing, but then you come away and it sticks. You've learned something about maybe yourself. I mean, I'm so starstruck. I can't not ever, ever not be starstruck around him because he's one of the only people I can't not lose that with. He's just got this effect on me. Anyway, so he's that. And then we went to his birthday and up in their castle. He had a castle up with them in the middle of Scotland and people were coming in from everywhere for it. It was an amazing event. It was like serious living Madame Tussauds. I was sitting next to Moon Unit and Dweezil Zappa.
Two of my favourite sods right there.
Two sods.
The thing is, I really don't like all of that.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit too much for me. And so I just went and found a room and just went and sat in this room and hid. And it was a two-day thing. So I had to leave the room and go to bed and things. And I'd go back to that room the next day just to not be in. It's just too much.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sitting in the room. It was this very nice, like a reading or a drawing room or whatever. I was sitting in this big sort of armchair with my back to the door. And I'd been there for hours and hours just having a nice chill and be by myself. Like about 4 hours in, door opens and I'm like, and door closes and then clip, clop. And it's Billy and he's like, the fuck are you doing here? And I'm like, I can't. And he's like, ah, me too. And he went there to escape as well. And he had the exact same thing. And it might be being from Glasgow or being Scottish, or I think he struggles with that as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he could have sorted that by not inviting those people.
Well, yeah, but I think there's Billy and Pamela.
Yeah.
You know, and Pam's amazing. She's the kind of organizer. She's the light bulb in the room. And Billy, very quiet, like me, and he likes his own company. And Pamela's the kind of, come on, everyone, let's have a party. Let's, you know, get everyone together and mix and mingle. And it's very much her thing.
Yeah.
But that was that. And then a few months later, we got a phone call from, I think it was Pam. She's like, we're going, would you want to...
Holiday time. Where'd you go? Centre Parks?
Yeah. We went to Fiji.
Holy shit.
It was just the whole, like, the whole trip there was just surreal. But I remember feeling slightly like just a deer caught in the headlights.
Yeah.
And
you probably got back to the UK and then just were ill for 5 weeks.
Yeah. I had a nervous breakdown. Yeah. The thing is, I'm not into that. I'm not into that sort of
the hobbing and the nobbing.
Not really, no. And I always had a bit of a weird inverse chip with fame and being this guy, you know, mm-hmm. this famous person.
Well, let's talk about that. Because I met you guys when you were on the cusp of all that.
Yeah.
And me and Joe were having our makeup done for a photo shoot, and it was, I guess, 1999. And I remember meeting Nora, and she was doing our makeup for this photo shoot.
I remember that.
And we got talking, and she said, oh, my boyfriend's in a band. I was like, oh, yeah. And she said, they're called Travis, and they've got a record coming out quite soon. It's called The Man Who. And I was like, oh, yeah, cool. And weirdly, I think the same week I was in HMV, and the DJ played, he was like, this is the new one from Travis. It's called Driftwood. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is the band that Nora was talking about. I was like, oh, cool, that sounds good. And then you came to our party.
Yeah.
You and Dougie.
That's right, yeah.
Because we had a TX party when our show went out. It was the third series, I think, and we went and had a big party in a place called the TARDIS.
Yes!
Up in Farringdon, the venue where a lot of artists worked and you could hire it out and... It was good fun, and there was lots of musicians there. I think I've told this story before, but Marky Smith and The Fall came because they'd been on the show. We invited them. We never thought they would come. And then the day before, no, actually that afternoon, the afternoon of the party, our producer said, oh, I just got a call from Mark Smith, and he said that he's going to come and bring a few members of the band. I was like, oh, my God. I was terrified that he was just going to cause havoc and... run around beating up my posh friends, which he didn't. He was really nice.
But you'd done something with him on that.
We
that
did a Vinyl Justice thing with him.
Vinyl Justice. I found that the other day. I found that whole shoot. I've got it. Nora filmed all of it. You come into the door and she was like a fly on the wall filming you filming us.
Yeah, because we did a thing with you for our fourth series.
Right.
I'm not sure we ever used it in the end. Because we were doing a pilot and the pilot didn't work out the way we wanted, but you very nicely helped us out and did a thing. What was it called? It was like a Vinyl Justice variant with videos. So we went round the TV detector van. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Me and Joe were dressed up like TV detectors and we raided your house.
That's right.
And you and Andy and Doug and Neil were sat there and we talked about what TV you watched, and we all sang Going for Gold.
That's right.
Going for gold. The heat is on. The time is right.
That's right.
It's time for you to play your game. Join in whenever you want. People are coming. Everyone's trying to do the best that they can.
I remember it was Andy who was most... like into that because he was the king of daytime TV at that time.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of chat about Dusty Bin and that kind of thing. Anyway,
TARDIS.
So we were back at the TARDIS. You came along and that was the first time that we met. And then we spent quite a lot of time together for the next few years, really. Mm. We became good friends very fast.
You came to America when we recorded the Invisible Band.
That's right.
I remember being in the bar before we started recording and going, oh, what's this going to be like? Whether it was going to work out or not. Nigel hadn't arrived yet. He was just coming off a kiddie.
Nigel Godrich.
Yeah.
Radiohead's producer. And he produced The Man Who.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he produced The Man Who with a couple of other people involved, but this was going to be solely Nigel.
Mm-hmm.
So we were waiting on him, I think, in some bar on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, that was incredibly exciting.
It was for all of us, wasn't it? It was like a sort of this kind of mad, what's going on here?
And that must have been when, 2000?
2000, yeah.
So that was the year that you had broken through by that time. The Man Who came out and was a bit of a sleeper hit. And then you did the Glastonbury performance. It started raining and everything kind of coalesced until, I think, in 2000, you were on the cover of Q and cover of pretty much every music magazine.
Yeah, it was mental.
And then you almost immediately started experiencing a little bit of a backlash. And what did that feel like? When I say backlash, I don't mean, it wasn't like horrible and vicious.
No,
I remember you were so ubiquitous.
Yeah, it was too much.
The Face magazine had a little
I Hate Travis badge. Which I wore on my cap.
Right.
Forever, because I kind of liked it. I thought it was quite cool to be that. The band had gotten that sort of big that we'd flipped into the other side of it, like you say, so quickly. That's not something that bothers me too much. Never really got on my nerves. It got more, I think, maybe later on, because by that time, yeah, the Invisible Band, we were still riding on the Man Who crest of a wave type of thing, and that the Invisible Band did well because of the Man Who, and that it was, the tsunami was still rolling. And then when everything settles down and the next bands come through and you just go back to sort of being in a band and touring and doing normal things, and you lose your force field and everyone starts, the vultures start coming in. That can get a little bit get a bit personal. We just made, like, the last thing we did before this record, a documentary about us called Almost Fashionable. And I got a critic to come, a guy who didn't like us, to come on the road with us and to sort of cover it, to try and figure it out, you know, like, what is it?
Yeah, what is it that winds up critics especially about Travis, and what were his conclusions?
Well, the gamble was, I've always thought that the Travis that was projected, because you've got no control over that. I'm always a little bit jealous of bands who seem to be able to control it. I mean, Radiohead's control of their optic is just amazing. I don't know if they do that deliberately or it's just, that's just them or whatever, but we've just, it's been totally, you can't really control that, I don't think. But I always found that the distortion of what we are and what I knew us to be to what was on the other side of it was so different. And I couldn't figure that out. Like, what's there not to like? We're not horrible. And the music's not terrible. So this guy coming in, I wanted to see. And sure enough, like, very quickly, he realises that this band here are not the same as that band there. But I think the big thing that I think rubs a lot of people up is that we're nice. This word, this horrible word, nice. Mm-hmm. And I think being Scottish, people are quite light-hearted there, and we have this lightness about us, and people are nice. Mm-hmm. But it's not a bad word, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that sort of wound folk up.
Well, I think traditionally the whole paradigm for a certain type of rock music, especially credible, authentic, I overuse the word authentic, but that kind of thing, especially for critics, it's got to be authentic, it's got to be grimy and dark, it's got to be angsty, it's got to be a cry of pain, a shout of rage. Those are the quintessential statements of rock music, a certain type of music. And even though there were elements of that in Travis's music, you know, you get that thrill, that visceral thrill from a lot of your songs. All I Want to Do Is Rock, and the big shouting screen there. But the fact that it was so accessible, a lot of it, and then The Man Who is just this lovely, lush sounding thing. I suppose inoffensive is a word that you could attach to it because it didn't jar. It wasn't grating. It was easy to like. It was very melodic.
And it sold almost 3 million copies.
Right. That's the thing that really is the irritating part, isn't it, for a certain type of critic.
But again, you don't have control over that, and you find yourself going, oh. But in the doc, we interviewed critics. Pete Pifades is brilliant in it. He nails it completely. And other journalists talk about exactly what you're saying. What's the story? What's the new story? And we didn't want to play that game, so neither did they. So they almost grudgingly had to follow in. Everything was playing their songs. They're like, oh, okay, Travis, right? But anyway, it was a mad time.
Yeah.
Mad.
Mm. At this point.
Yes.
How'd you feel about playing a song?
Yeah.
Just to remind us what we're dealing with. I'm going to swing my mic around onto your guitar.
Oh, yeah. Ready? Do you know what I'm going to play?
Out of Space.
No.
What is it? That's lovely. Is that 12 Memories?
No, that was the Invisible Band.
That's the Invisible Band.
That's why I was playing it, because that was one of the songs we were recording when you were out that time.
Yes, in Ocean Way. How amazing it was to be in Ocean Way.
Well, it's a brilliant studio.
So for people that don't know, put it in context a little bit.
Ocean Way is a studio in Los Angeles where we recorded the Invisible Band with Nigel Godrich in 2000. And it's a really amazing studio because, well, it's an old studio. It's got a lot of history. Frank Sinatra did a lot of recording there. Everyone, it was one of those very, very busy studios back in the day. Wrecking Crew, that sort of thing. Those guys were jumping in and out of those studios.
Beach Boys were there, weren't they?
The thing is, all of these bands were in and out of all of those studios because they go back to the 50s and 60s.
It's a cool place, and it's all wood paneled, vaulted ceilings, like everywhere in Los Angeles when the sun goes down, low lit, lots of fairy lights.
Yeah.
Because when I went out there, I think you were coming towards the end of the sessions, and I went out there with my video camera, and I filmed more or less the whole of Sing coming together.
You've got that on?
Yeah. I think so. I've got a lot of it.
That's great. I would love to see that. I'll swap you TV detectives for that.
Okay, cool. I know I digitized it recently. It was lovely watching it again.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, this is great. And there's one bit, because you recorded a lot of it in the round.
Yeah, well, Neil's behind the glass.
Yeah.
Because the drum spill was too loud. It would go in the mics. But yeah, live. That's what Nigel's thing is, you know, gets everyone playing live.
And then you had, I remember you saying that you had another alternate lyric for Sing.
What was that? Really?
Which was...
Oh, God.
Lately, you've been going so crazy. Lately, you've been going so crazy. Yeah. Lazy, I've been driving Miss Daisy.
That's right. What a terrible lyric. You know, but this is the thing that I read a nice article. Tom York was talking about at the moment there's 20 years or 25 years since Kid A. Mm-hmm. 20 years
Must
since Kid
20,
A. Yeah. And at the time he wrote, he did something with Q or one of these magazines where he said he just hates all melody, makes him feel so uncomfortable and just didn't like it. And the thing is, I know that feeling. because that's the feeling that you have to go through to find a good melody. And at the end of it, and Tom's one of the I think, in my opinion, greatest rock melody writers. But he, that process of writing shit like that, like, I mean, it just comes out and you just have to take it and go, oh, and realise that, you know, you're only as good as the shittest thing that you ever wrote. So you're always going to be shit, but you need to eat that humble pie. You have to do that to grind down your ego until it's just decimated. And then just beyond that is the wee thing that you want, you know, a little bit of gold or the diamond or whatever you want to call it.
Do you have a memory of a time when a song came easily and pleasurably and you were pleased with the result? A Simple Birth?
I think Sing's a good example of that. That was like watching MTV with the sound turned down, just looking at the pictures, and there was some thing about swing beat, and I was playing this thing and I was like, if you swing, 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 that's quite good. Swing, swinging in a swing, when you're like this feeling when you're in the park when you're little. So I went into the studio the next day and I'm going to the guys, check this out. If you swing, and Dougie immediately like, swing? You're writing a song about swinging? I'm like, oh, yeah, right, okay. My mind was all on the park and going, wee-hee! And Dougie was chucking his keys in the bowl. And I'm having a dinner party somewhere in Giffnock. So then I thought, yeah, well, what if we changed it to Sing? But that came like that.
I was talking to you before we started recording about how things changed for you when you became a father and when your priorities shifted away from feeling that you had to write songs all the time, more to just being a dad.
Yeah.
But now, well, tell me about the conversation you had with Clay.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about how I was sitting at the piano about, it was about a year and a half ago, and Clay came in and he's like, Papa, I think you should do the band. I think I'm done. I'm good, you know, because we'd been talking maybe a week earlier about life with the band. I don't go on the road and don't, you know, I sort of don't do the whole away for weeks and weeks and weeks, because I wanted to be here and be a dad and put my thing into you. And
that sounds sexy.
Put my thing into you. Put reverb on that. And he was like, all right. And I think at that point he came back a week later and he's like, no, you know, and I'd said in some interview the other day, it's like Pinocchio kind of getting off the workbench and being like, right, stop sanding, I'm good, I can walk, look, go back and start making your sideboards again, Geppetto. So I feel like I'm able to fully like concentrate. I feel like I've gotten quite cool songs come through.
Has the process of writing songs changed over the years?
No, still like pulling teeth.
Still like pulling teeth.
Yeah. Do you know that film, There Will Be Blood?
Yeah, man.
That's a great film, right?
Yeah.
Bastard in a Basket.
Yes. I love that. And he's down that hole at the beginning.
Yeah, man.
And he's just like, he's got his pickaxe and he's whacking the thing, and then he puts the wee bit of dynamite in, goes up, blows it up, comes back down, breaks his leg. And that, to me, watching that's the creative process. You're in this hole and you're chipping away and it's so boring and there's nothing creative about it.
Which is the creative part then for you?
Once you get the wee germ of the idea, whether it's if you swing, swing, the rest of it just comes out very quickly and everything just fills itself in. And when doing that, when you get that, when that happens, that's the addictive part of, you want that. So once you get that song done, you want to try again. So you start digging again. Because really there is, when a song finds you, and I don't think you find the song, I think it reveals itself to you. I think that's the feeling. You're finding something that was there already. You're just, you remember in Scooby-Doo when they throw the paint over the Invisible Man?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, there he is! And the guy's like, you rascal kids. That's, to me, the songs are, they're not even songs, but stories and things are just out there floating about, and your job is just to sit. If you're quiet enough and kind of still enough, then they come to you.
I think a song is just trying to bubble up from my stomach.
What's it called?
You know, I try and write songs, because
I love your
songs.
The
song songs maybe is too grand a word for them. They're jingles, but I do try and write jingles. And man, during the lockdown, holy Moses, how many songs about biscuits can I write? It's just, I'm so literal minded. All I can do is write songs about my everyday routine. How do you manage to abstract your way of thinking to the extent that you can write about a feeling, you can evoke a feeling? Literally, I just wrote a song about a tea towel the mm-hmm. other day that wasn't very absorbent. And I thought, yeah, that's pretty good.
Because that's the two ways of writing. One is designing and one is divining. And at its best, it's a combination of both. The Beatles there's that funny story, or not funny story, cool story about them in the back of the car. And they need to write a song tomorrow because they're going in to do a session, or they're doing the album. They're one song short. And Lennon's like, oh, what are you going to write the song about? And Carl's like, I'll write it about what you doing there. And he's got a book and he's like, okay, I'll write. And he wrote Paperback Writer. He used that thing. So he's designing. But there's also the divining thing, which is he woke up singing Yesterday, or the melody for Yesterday. It just was there. It's like howling or something, and it just kind of comes out. So you have to just try and switch your brain off.
Because whenever I've tried to write a serious song, and I have a few times, like if I'm feeling sad, for example, I've noticed in times where I felt really sad and lonely and desperate that music definitely is a comfort, massive comfort. Mm. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if I could write a song in this moment that would cheer me up, also capture some part of the essence of this feeling and turn it into art? Anyway, it's fucking impossible.
But you're almost there. It's just the difference is I think it's a lyric thing. Just forget about language for a second, because language is like the very last part of the whole process. But just sitting and making noises and, I really hate anyone can hear me writing. It's so embarrassing because you sound like you're speaking in tongues a little bit, like, and at some point, if you lose your mind a little bit and you're recording it and something happens and there's no lyrics, there might be maybe a lyric there, but you're just waiting for this moment and then it might come or it might not. But usually it doesn't. Usually it's just, most of the time, it's Driving Miss Daisy and it's horrible. And that feeling is just, you just feel like shit most of the time. And that's why I really hate songwriting. I really do.
But you must love the result, though. You must love all those children that you've brought into the world, those musical children.
Because they're wonderful.
I was listening to your stuff. I mean, your stuff pops up a lot on my phone anyway, and it's always welcome when it does. And then knowing that I was going to see you, I made a playlist on Spotify, which I will put in the description of this podcast, of some of my favourite Travis songs. Mm-hmm. Apart from the fact that they remind me of a very happy time hanging out with you guys, there really is a special thing that they do, which is, apart from being melodic and accessible, there's a vulnerability to them and a sweetness to them that is wonderful and made me very emotional listening to them. And you must be proud of those, that you've created those things which affect people that way.
Yeah. I was thinking about it the other day, and it was in LA, when you're in your car, because you spend a lot of time driving around, and there's a lot of dicks in other cars who will flip you off and shout at you through their window. And what's happening there, when someone does that, road rages you, and I get really, it makes me so, cramps me up. I get really sad and angry as well, obviously. But you get so sad. So what's actually happening there is they're going, "Fuck you, you fucking," and then you get to feel how they feel. That energy or whatever it is, it's like they've taken a spoonful of themselves and gone, "Here, taste this spoonful of shit." And you're like, "That's disgusting." But you're tasting how they feel, right?
Yeah.
And this is how I try and square that so I don't need to own it, because it's not how I feel at that moment. I've just tasted them and it's horrible.
So you are spooning your musical shit into them.
Yeah.
Into the mouth.
No, I'm spooning angel. Ears. You can spoon shit, or it could be angel delight.
Yeah.
Right. So, but the same thing applies with songs. You, when you write a song, it's there and it comes out and you get this lovely feeling of its arrival. that you've it's landed on you or it's discovered you or you've discovered it or whatever it is you want to call it. But there it is, and you get this amazing, oh, there's no feeling, honestly, like it, apart from when you hear a song that connects to you. And it's weird and magical and like addictive, like nothing you've ever, it's better than wanking. I mean, not, it's about the only thing about, just a bit better, maybe just a wee bit better than wanking. Not much, but it's just got the edge.
A lot of it is very similar to wanking as well.
Yeah, you sit at the end of your bed, you pull out your instrument, you start strumming gently at first.
Yeah.
And then you
build to the climax. Anyway, we've done this already. But I'm afraid we've already laid the foundations for the argument story.
Oh, go on.
The row.
Yeah, we had a bad row.
We've spoken about this since, right?
Yeah. The day after.
We spoke about it the day after and since then. You tell the story and I'll interject if I think you've got anything wrong. Or would you rather I told it?
I was thinking about this the other day because we were really drunk.
Yep. I was thinking, just to preface, I don't think I've ever been so drunk since.
Yeah.
And I think it just isn't part of my life now. It's not possible physically for me to get that hammered.
I don't think any of us...
I wouldn't want to.
...did that even then. It was just one of those nights that was long. It was a sustained...
Yeah, it was a long day.
A very, very long, sustained drinking session that just went on and on and culminated in an explosive finale.
Mm.
And as I can remember it, it was Simon Pegg's wedding.
Simon and Maureen were getting married, and it was 2005?
Could be. And we all went to the thing. And I don't know how to tell this story.
Well, one of the foundations you need to set in place is that among the guests were Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin.
Right. So we all went to the wedding, and it was lovely.
Yeah,
and
it really was.
And then we went to the after party thing, and then we went into the party and I can't remember much else, and then me and you were sitting on a chair and there was a girl there. I don't know who it was.
It wasn't Gwyneth Paltrow.
It was definitely not. They'd gone. And then you were like, "You fucking prick," or something. You said something really not nice. You called me a fucking you're a fucking wanker or something like that. And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "Do you know what I'm talking about in the church today?" And I knew exactly what you were, and I felt really self-conscious about this one moment, which was we were in the church at the end of the wedding. It was really nice, and Gwyneth and Chris were there, and we used to go and we'd hang out every now and then. So we were like, they were like, "Oh, hi," and everyone had evacuated from the church, and we were just standing chatting and going, "Oh, la la," and they were like, "We're going to go out this door."
Out the back.
Out the back door. And I was like, "Oh." And so I was caught in this moment of normal people, superstars. And I didn't, they were like, "Come on." And I was like, it was almost like the bit where someone's like, "Here, have some meth." And you're like, I don't really want to hurt your feelings. And okay. Oh, fuck. So we went into their car or whatever and drove off.
Special door. They wanted to avoid the paps.
Yeah. So I went out and you were like, "You." And it was just, it felt, and it was, had you done that with just me, but it was this other, the girl that was sitting, that I was so embarrassed that you embarrassed me in front of this girl. I got up and I left and my feelings were absolutely fucking destroyed. And I was getting in the taxi and you came out and you're like, "What are you doing?" And you were like, really aggressive. I'd never seen you so aggressive before. And I was like taken aback and I just started crying because someone was shouting at me like a grown-up. Like you suddenly became a grown-up. And you're like, "Da, da, da." And I can't remember what you said. And I was like, and we sort of made up there and then. I think we just were drunk or whatever. And that was that. And then you came in the next day and that was that. But,
well...
damn.
That is not exactly the way I remember it.
Oh, right.
I mean, those are the basic facts.
Yeah, yeah.
I said at the beginning that I, you know, was going to tell the story because it kind of tied in with me encouraging you to do a lot of name dropping in this podcast. And the thing is that I think that, you know, part of the fun of going and hanging out with you guys in those days was that it was like, wow, this is what it's like. I got to see secondhand what it was like to be in kind of A-list company. There were stars coming and going, and, you know, Noel Gallagher might turn up. And it was amazing tagging along with you guys. Yeah. And it was fascinating for me. I had quite an unhealthy interest in that side of celebrity and that sort of thing, you know. So even though it wore off a little bit and I got used to it and I adjusted to it and I saw that, okay, it's not all like that and a lot of it's bullshit. But there was still quite a lot of that residual fascination with that world there. And I think it used to just get peaked every now and again.
Yeah.
And that was one of those days when it did, when I saw, it was like, oh, Gwyneth. And it was kind of like, wow, this is kind of weird and crazy and fun. But I also knew you very well.
Yeah.
And so I felt as if I was able to tease you about it.
Oh, yeah.
And you wouldn't get upset. Because I thought you understood that, of course,
I know.
I love you. And of course, I don't really think that you're shallow at all. And and I was showing off. I was showing off. Look at me. I'm teasing my famous friend about going with the other famous people. I'm Mr. Celeb Bantz guy. Oh, dear. I was hammered. My judgment was all off. My timing was all off. Everything, all the dials were going
Your
wrong.
Voice still echoes in my head going, you fucking
I can't believe I said that. And if I did, it was like, supposed to be a joke.
I know, but it was...
I think what I was doing was taking the piss out of someone who would genuinely think that. I was taking the piss out of a twat.
I know. The thing is, I know that now.
You know.
Yeah. And I knew that as soon as you came out and you shouted.
But again, the shouting thing, I'll tell you exactly what that was, because I do remember that bit. Mm-hmm. Was that you were not making sense by that point. You were really fucked off and really drunk. We were both hammered.
And you wanted to snap me out of it?
Yeah. We were communicating.
No, yeah, it was necessary. But it's like, it was amazing. It was like a moment.
Well, it was like, I think I remember my dad getting angry with us when we were little and, you know, suddenly if there was just too much noise and too much hysteria, he would just suddenly, now stop doing that now! And it would just be like, whoa, okay. You know, and I was trying to talk to you and you were sort of a bit teary and hysterical. You were like, no, but you meant that. And you do, you know, and you were making valid criticisms and you were pointing out quite rightly that I'd been a tit. But you weren't listening. I was trying to apologize and I was saying, listen, man, I'm so sorry. And I didn't mean that. And you know I love you. But you weren't listening.
I was already there. I know. I was gone. I was in my...
At a certain point, I was just like, okay.
I love you, Adam.
I love you too, man. And I'm sorry for shouting at you. And I'm sorry for doing that stupid joke. And I'm sorry for being such a shallow, starstruck tit.
Let's have a wank.
Come on, then. I would love you to play another song because it would be lovely just to have one to wrap the whole thing up.
I don't know. This is called Butterflies. Chasing butterflies by the water, watching aeroplanes because you got it inside. Everything is wrong outside. Eyes on the prize and your head in your hands. Oh, you can't see the wood for the trees even when all the leaves are gone. 'Cause you're still chasing butterflies, watching all the years roll by. About it.
but you never did a thing about it. Just waste time. Waste time, everything is wrong, but you're fine. And your head in your hands. Oh, you can't see the wood for the trees even when all the leaves are gone, 'cause you're still chasing butterflies. Watch it all the years roll by. But we soldiers soldier on. Yeah, we soldiers soldier on. Inside, inside everything is wrong, but you're fine. Ooh, you're fine. You keep your eyes on the prize. You can't see the wood for the trees even when all the leaves are gone, 'cause you're still chasing butterflies. Watch it all the years roll by. It's waiting for your ship to arrive. You're still
this is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right. Stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No. It's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
And put my thing into you.
Hey, welcome back, Podcats. Well, you know, he said that I should put some reverb on that line, so that's what I did. Fran Healy there. I'm very grateful to Fran and the rest of the band and to Samantha Scott for all her help organizing things that day. Much appreciated. As I said, I have put together a Spotify compilation of some of my favorite Travis tracks, and I've kind of stayed away on the whole from the really big ones in an effort to take a more offbeat route into their music. The thing about Travis is that you've got, as well as the big anthems, you've got a lot of really lovely, engaging, arty pop songs in there, which is kind of my favourite music. And, you know, my friend Dougie from the band has very similar taste to mine. lots of Bowie and arty pop. And you can hear that in some of Travis's stuff. So anyway, link in the description of the podcast to that Spotify playlist. I hope you check it out and enjoy it and maybe discover a few things that you weren't aware of before. So how's things, podcats? Hope you're doing all right. Ooh, wow, a bat. Hello, bat. Flitting around, probably shitting and pissing on my head. There's a couple of bats, actually probably more than a couple, that live in the barn where I work. And in the big barn, in the main area, is where I've got various musical instruments set up. Whoa, there's so many bats out here. There's about 10 or something flitting around. I'm walking down in the gloaming and walking next to some trees and bushes, and all the bats are just coming out and flitting. But yeah, in the barn, this is the time of year. Actually, it's coming towards the time of year where they go back to sleep again, I think. But for the last couple of months, they've been partying every night, which means every day I have to hoover up all their bat turds and wipe away the wee-wee, bat-wee. The bat-wee is actually potentially corrosive to metal, so I've got to cover up all the symbols and things like that. Beautiful bats. Anyway, whoa! Big pheasant just flew out of the undergrowth. I was in mental bat mode, though, so I thought it was a bat. And I was just thinking, fucking hell, that's a big bat. That's exciting, though. This is why Rosie likes this time of night. It is, I reckon we've got about 10 more minutes of visibility left before we are plunged into total darkness. Rosie, come on, we should head back. Totally ignoring me. Anyway, look, podcasts, before I go today, I just wanted to give a plug for a thing. I don't know the people involved, but it looked like a good thing. Portraits for NHS heroes. Earlier in the year, during the first lockdown, everyone was celebrating the frontline workers and the NHS doctors and nurses and clapping every evening and all that kind of thing. But now it seems with the second lockdown, everybody's a little more pissed off and it's more controversial and more political, and perhaps some of the focus has come off the people who are still working so hard in the NHS, even though, of course, the lockdown is really all about the NHS in some ways. But, of course, this year has just reminded us of what we should have known all along, which was, and what we did know all along, which was how important these people are and how grateful we are to them. And so this NHS Portraits for Heroes book has been put together in that spirit. Here's the blurb. At the start of the lockdown, artist Tom Croft decided to pay tribute to our amazing NHS workers by painting a portrait of NHS nurse Harriet Durkin for free, and encouraged other artists to do the same. You can see over 13,000 of these submissions on Instagram with hashtag portraits for NHS heroes, but they have also now been compiled into a book with Bloomsbury Publishing. It's coming out on the 12th of November, and the royalties go to NHS charities. They're kind enough to send me a copy, and the portraits are really fantastic. It's not like kind of amateur scribbles. I think these are all professional portrait artists, or many of them are anyway. And there's just an incredible wealth of talent and different styles of art going on. Really brilliant portraits of these people in all kinds of different states, some with their masks on and their surgical gowns on, some of them in various emotional states. It's really a beautiful thing. At the very least, a good way to remember this year and so much of what it was all about. Link in the description of the podcast. That's it for this week. Thank you very much indeed, once again, to Fran.
And to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for production support, to Matt Lamont for conversation editing, and to Helen Green for podcast artwork. Thanks to Acast for their continued hard work and support. But most especially, thank you very much to you for listening to another episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you're doing all right out there. Until next time, for goodness sake, take care. And if there isn't any available, just nick someone else's. No, don't do that. Have some of mine in audio hug form. Oh, look, fireworks. And don't forget, I love you. Bye! Thumbs up.